The following is a message by Dave Nutting, entitled 50 Scientific Reasons Evolution is Wrong.
First, I want to say one thing about evolution and creation, that we really look at things and say, how does that fit with what we're doing? Well, think about the UFOs and think about what's going on. You know what? One thing that Chuck Missler was presenting, UFOs, and how is this going to all fit in? Well, if you stop and think about it, I've read some evolutionary things. It says, when we finally make contact with these beings on other planets, since they're going to be so much older, so much more evolved than us, we'll think them to be gods. Oh. Well, we're going to become gods ourselves. The New Age movement is solidly based in evolution as well. And in fact, if you know what evolution teaches, you're going to become a god yourself, aren't you? Well, that's what New Age teaches on the evolution. You're going to evolve into one. And then as far as how it relates to society today, you know, if you're nothing but a glorified animal, what's wrong with abortion, homosexuality, euthanasia? You're going to make your own mind up on things, aren't you? So, and then if you want to make laws, if we're in an evolving society like we pretty well accepted, well, it's time to have an evolving constitution too, instead of a static one. So 1962, that's when basically we started moving that direction to an evolving constitution, no longer based on precedents. So that's what's going on in the society today, and we just have to understand that. The root, the whole foundation, a lot of this stuff that we see in this country going on is evolution. Well, let me go ahead and begin the slides here. Try that one right there. Power button. Got to figure out how to use these machines. We are going to be talking about 50 scientific reasons evolution is true. Before I even get into it, let's explain what the model of evolution teaches. Basically, all life forms started in a kind of a gooey, soupy mixture. They're in the bottom of the ocean, sometimes in the atmosphere, they say. But somehow or another, out of that particular mixture, a first cell evolved. And then over millions and millions of years, that cell evolved, and pretty soon fish came on the scene. And then before long, not only did you have fish, you ended up with amphibians and reptiles and mammals and eventually you. Now, this is evolution. It's an ever-going up progression of steps, getting better and better all along. You might call this method of evolution the goo to you by way of the zoo method of getting life. And, you know, according to evolution, we should see these broad changes across kinds. And, of course, mutations are what's supposed to be fueling all this, so we should see beneficial mutations propelling this upward. Well, it's one thing to imagine that, but is it really observation? We can imagine cells turning into people, but guess what? All we have are the ends of the branches. You see that entire trunk, the entire branches that's drawn in there? That is the imagination part. And I want to make that clear today. Science is based on observation, and what we have to do when we deal with scientific evidences is imagine a lot of things. Now, we are in the business of observing as scientists. What do we see when we go out and observe things? Well, we look at finches, and Darwin noted these and said, look at all the different size and shapes, beaks on these finches. Therefore, one finch evolved into another one. There's the imagination part. Okay? We can look at minute changes in color variation between the peppered moths and say, one moth must have evolved into another moth. Well, that's not exactly right either, and we know that. Evolution is going to have to explain how you get moths. And in fact, these small, very minute changes actually fit well with the creation model, much more than it does the evolution model. The creation model says at one time God created everything, and there was a lot of room for variation. So you can get all kinds of different type of dogs. You can get big dogs, little dogs, and within the dog kind, you notice, we can get all of that by selective breeding with no evolution going on whatsoever. And I see more or less difference between the different type of dogs here than I do between peppered moths and between the different types of finches. What evolution needs to do is figure out how these small changes can amount to what's called major changes. So can evolution explain this? And my answer is no, and I want to give you about 50 reasons why it doesn't work. First, I want to say I used to believe in this evolution. So can evolution model? In fact, this is a picture of me clear back in the fourth grade, just before I grew a beard, okay? And I was teaching on a television program how the study of fossils proved evolution. And it wasn't until my third year of college teaching that I finally realized there were some scientific problems with evolution. And scientifically, I ended up giving up evolution and then looked at it biblically. Kind of backwards for me than it is for a lot of people. But it was very effective, and I realized that what I observe is that evolution is not happening in the present, it's not happening in the past. And let me show you some of the things you would expect to find. You'd expect to find some new kinds, wouldn't you, if evolution is true? Maybe you should be popping into existence. No, we don't see it. We don't even see any new structures coming into existence. And then when we look in the real world, we see all of a sudden we have distinct gaps between the kinds. That sounds like creation. God created things after their own kind, not one kind changing into another kind. Another thing we see is no life is coming from non-life anywhere. We've never observed it, period. And in fact, Green and Goldberger, a couple of evolutionists, have stated it this way. He says, the macromolecule to cell transition is a jump of fantastic dimensions, which lies beyond the range of testable hypothesis. In this area, all is conjecture. The available facts do not provide a basis for postulating that cells arose on this planet. First of all, he's saying it's a big leap of faith. And then he's saying that you can't even test it. That means you can't observe it, so it's not even science. And it's a big guess. And then he says, and the facts don't support it. These are evolutionists. And yet, what are they actually presenting in textbooks? Life from non-life, and we know it cannot happen. Well, mutations, the driving force of evolution, are supposed to be beneficial. But when we look at it, they're not. They're rare, they're random, and they're usually harmful. Not beneficial at all. Most of you know about the problems. We look at mutations like deformed hands or the result of a nuclear accident in the next generation. They're not something you like. And we've been noting mutations do not lead upward like evolution says. That, say, fruit flies supposedly are going to get better and better and better. And we've been mutations, if you bombard them with radiation, and we should produce something better, when we actually look at the evidence, what do we find out? We end up with fruit flies after treatment with shriveled wings. No wings. Nothing better, is there? Not at all. Observation shows that we do not have things going from worse to better. It goes the opposite direction. Well, we also see that extinction is the rule. That's in the living record and in the fossil record. We have a lot of things that lived in complete forms, died out today, nothing leading up to it. We also notice stasis, not change in the fossil record. By that I mean, things in the fossil record look a lot like we have today. There you see a starfish. And we have starfish exactly like in the fossil record. We look at horseshoe crabs right next to a living one, a one that just died. You see hardly any change whatsoever. Shells, identical. How about shrimp, identical? And I can give you all kinds of examples, but that's enough. Stasis, not change. That shows that there were distinct boundaries between the kinds. We also find out of order fossils as well. In fact, if you look at the geologic column, when I was teaching on the television program clear back in the fourth grade, I was saying that life went from very, very simple to very, very complex. If you dig down to the bottom layers, life was very simple down there. And I said, everything fits this order. Well, that's not exactly true. And in fact, we look at that geologic column. Fish supposedly evolved way up here in the column. But in the Cambria now, they have found fish scales. If the scales are there, the fish have to be there too, right? Another thing too, you would expect to find insects evolving right up into here. But now they have found spiders and spider webs on the Devonian-Silurian boundary. Now, what do you think those spider webs were trying to catch if the insects hadn't evolved until multiple millions of years later? That's a problem for evolution, isn't it? According to evolution, advanced plants happened way up here about the head of the dinosaur near the Cretaceous. That would be oak trees, etc. So what would you do if you found an oak tree clear down here below the Permian? Well, this particular one was found in Pennsylvanian shales, and there you see an oak leaf with lepidodendron. These are the lepidodendron is your major coal-forming fern. They're there together, 150 million years out of place. Something's wrong here, isn't it? Out-of-order fossils, we see them, they're abundant in the geologic record. We also see fossils that transcend many layers of the geologic column. This one going through at least 100 million years of evolutionary time frame. What do you do as a geologist when you come face to face with a single petrified tree going through all those million years? You all of a sudden realize those million years never existed. Instead, this probably indicates a period of major water catastrophe such as Noah's flood. And I think that would work very well. Down in the very bottom layers of the chart I showed you a little bit ago, the Cambrian, you find these things called trilobites. They're supposed to be simple because life goes from simple to complex. But when you focus in on the head of the trilobite, you find out they had eyes. And in fact, it's a very compound, complex eye similar to dragonflies today. Simple? Where's all the simplicity leading up to this complexity? You go down lower in the layers, you don't even find it. Life is complex wherever you find it. Well, Grolier Multimedia Encyclopedia, in fact, even knows this. 1995 edition says, one of the most difficult problems in evolutionary paleontology has been the almost abrupt appearance of the major animal groups, close this, and phyla, in full-fledged form in the Cambrian and Ordovician periods. This must reflect a sudden acquisition of skeletons by the various groups, in itself a problem. Things all of a sudden coming to existence, that's not the way evolution should work. Well, you also find out there's not a single tree. When it all of a sudden comes into existence, what do we find? We find all the different groups. And then, what do we find? A little bit of variation within the kinds of those groups, but not one thing changing to the other. We don't have a single tree. We have a forest of trees. That speaks of instantaneous creation with a lot of variety, doesn't it? Not evolution. Well, another big problem for evolution, as reported in American Scientist, May, June, 1997. There are no obvious simpler or intermediate forms, either living or in the fossil record, that show convincingly how modern arthropods evolved. It's a big problem because that represents a huge chunk of the animal kingdom. All right? All of a sudden, things fully formed and nothing leading up to them. Now, you should expect to find a lot of transitions in the fossil record, but you don't. All you have are the end products, nothing in between. And while I was teaching on the college level, this took me by great surprise because I thought the museums were full of them. Then I read quotations like this one from David Kitts. The bottom line there, evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology, the study of fossils, does not provide them. That's an evolutionist writing in the magazine called Evolution. But what's going on here? This is different than what we were told, right? Actually, we find out we have no transitions from invertebrate to vertebrates, nothing leading up to the fish, nothing from fish to amphibian, nothing from amphibian to reptile, and nothing from reptile to mammal. Now, somebody may object and say, wait a minute, I think they found a couple. Well, maybe, but you need more than one or two. You need hundreds of thousands of these things if it's going to work. And the one or two that they might point to are very suspect, even among evolutionists themselves. Even Archaeopteryx, you see that on your sheet there. Well, wait a minute. If they don't have these intermediates, what about all this nice artwork we see in magazines and textbooks? Well, it's just exactly that, artwork. You see something like that, and this is supposedly the land animal, such as a cow or a pig, turning into a whale, and you say, wait a minute, there's the evidence on the front cover of Science magazine, in fact. There it is. They must have found it. Well, no, they didn't find the whole thing. You need, when you see a picture like this, to ask a question, what's the evidence? So what is the actual evidence for this particular creature? A couple of teeth, one bone at the back of the head, and that is all. Only the portion of the skull that's dark there in color. They found no bones in the back, legs, tail, nothing. Now, is that enough evidence to get that great artwork and make that great claim that bones prove whale walked? Of course not. It's the artist that convinces us that evolution is true and not the actual evidence. Well, here's another one. This is another transition, supposedly, to whales. It's kind of like a dog-like kind, and there's the jaw, but that's all they have. And you see there's a lot of imagination going into this picture, isn't there? A lot of artwork. Now remember, imagination is not observation. Keep that in mind. All right. In a third grade textbook, it shows how the fish crawls out of the ocean and changes into the amphibians and the reptiles. Well, what did they find in between these? Nothing. Not one scrap of bone ever found in between these two. But look what it says at the very top of the page, the last line. Transitional forms, fossil forms, or missing links show how the process took place. How can something missing they never found show anything? They don't have the evidence, do they? Again, they can imagine what those things ought to look like, but they're not there. Unfortunately, our young people look at these textbooks and think, oh, evolution is a proven fact. In fact, they have all the evidence for human evolution. Well, human evolution is in trouble. What you see here at the bottom of that slide is good what? Artwork. That's right. Well, what was that evidence for that guy in the center? You look at the museum at Denver. They used to have it. You see the skull. You see the reconstruction. A lot of imagination going on, because what you don't know most of the time is all they found is a part of the skull that's dark in color. Everything else from the eyebrow on down was added for your viewing enjoyment in the museum exhibit. It wasn't there. The original Neanderthal was once considered to be very primitive and stooped over, and the kind of guy had passed for a good college wrestling coach. You've seen him before. Well, they now have more evidence for that, and they realize Neanderthal was fairly close to human, not this half-ape. The only thing, in fact, he would go totally unnoticed in a crowd, especially at the university. You might have heard of the new DNA study that they've been doing, but they did that whole study based upon, I understand, 350 segments out of 16,500. And most people say, wait a minute, this is too early to say anything, and they are 100% right. Okay? Don't get taken in by what the latest journal or newspaper article is saying. Here are two views of Zinjanthropus, one done for Dr. Louis Leakey, the other one for Dr. Kenneth Oakley. Now, what do you have? Two scientists working with their artists, coming up with completely different pictures. Great imagination, right? That's right. That's not observation. They never had a Polaroid camera picture of any one of these guys, did they? Well, you see the man and his friend, the guy's carrying a club and the camel's in the background. You say, wow, I hope they had the whole skeleton. No, here's all they had, a single tooth, and that's it. One tooth, the whole tooth, but nothing but that tooth. And they not only figured out what he ate and how he walked, whether or not he used tools, but evidently who his friends were from that single tooth, right? Well, they were digging in the bank. They found more of the evidence that went with what they called Nebraska Man there. And they found out they didn't have Nebraska Man at all. They had the original Nebraska Cornhusker, a type of pig, and that's all. Well, second grade textbook, actually, or it's a supplemental book used in the public school system. It shows Mr. Rhomopithecus was a man ape, wasn't a real man. Well, what's the evidence for this guy? That's a question we need to ask. Two small shreds of a jaw, and that's all. Based upon that, they not only got Mr. Rhomopithecus, but on the next page of the book, they got the rest of the family in there too. And that's really stretching the evidence. A lot of imagination, not actual observation. A lot of you have heard about Lucy, the Australopithecine, and some people have said, if you don't believe in evolution, you will when you see the bones of Lucy. Well, I saw what they found. Guess what? It doesn't prove evolution at all. Not at all. And you see great artwork. they found a skeleton that didn't have a head on it at that time, and they got a great picture of Lucy's head and figured out she was all burned hair too, right? One thing that they do is put a composite picture together of fossil finds they think belongs to the same species to get a composite picture of what the creature looked like in general. So a lot of the information you get over the news media is basically the composite picture. And in one case, they have a composite picture that shows the knee joint of Lucy, but that was not found with the rest of the skeleton. It was from a different find, the Hadar knee. And then now they have a skull for Lucy found a mile away in a different direction, the knee joint found 2 miles away roughly, but a composite picture. You know, there's a lot of room for error here, right? You can imagine what I'd find, or imagine, you can say, if I put a head of a horse together with a bumper of an automobile and assume they went together when they didn't. A lot of room for mistakes, and I think in this area of human evolution, a lot of mistakes have been made. Well, Russell Kielkorn from University of Iowa in Discover, January 1996, said this, human evolution is bushy. Not a tree, it's a bush with branches that go nowhere. In fact, you don't have Australopithecus leading to Homo habilis, leading to Homo erectus, leading to Homo sapiens. This lineal idea is just kind of bogus. It says, it was all very simple in the past, but it's all wrong. All wrong, okay? Well, I believe, after studying human evolution, it's in big trouble. Big trouble. Well, what about this other idea? When young people look at these textbooks, they've given an idea of man has come up through the ranks. And they're convinced evolution is true, and if they think they're nothing but an animal, then how do they act in school? All right. Well, it turns out when you really look at the evidence, ancient man wasn't that primitive. They built things that we have a hard time building today. They moved rocks we can't move today. Really amazing what they had. That's a whole other lecture in itself. Well, also we find, turning a little bit, evolution contradicts the known laws of science. One of the first ones, law of cause and effect. It takes a greater cause to produce an effect. You don't get language from non-language. You don't get information from non-information. Right? It takes greater intelligence to produce intelligence. Law of cause and effect. Another couple of laws are the laws of thermodynamics. And in thermodynamics, you find out there's two laws, two problems with evolution. First of all, let's go way back. We're going to go back before that cell, before that goo, you might say, way down there. And how did the goo get there? Well, evolution, you go far enough back there, has to say, well, there was some kind of stellar evolution. The stars just happened to form. Well, where did they come from? Well, you go back to either there was eternal matter, or matter somehow popped into existence someplace. Well, if matter popped into existence, it goes against the first law of thermodynamics. And if all of a sudden we have eternal matters, it goes against second law of thermodynamics because things in the universe run down, don't they? We don't have as much energy left in the universe available for work. So we see it goes against both of these laws of science. The second law of thermodynamics you're familiar with, you don't paint your house, falls down, doesn't it? Yeah, that's kind of a loose statement. It's actually an energy-type equation statement. But evolution says, yeah, we can go against the second law of thermodynamics. We're going to get back to that in just a little bit. Well, let's go to one of the models for stellar evolution, the Big Bang Theory. It goes against the second law of thermodynamics. We know that explosions don't produce order, right? They produce chaos. It's pretty obvious. And yet, that's how we got the whole universe, is when one major explosion and all the order in the universe came into being. Well, there are some problems with star formation. Even if you have a Big Bang, and it doesn't matter if you use other models other than the Big Bang to get the universe, you still have a problem with how were stars created. Well, here's a publication here, and basically he's saying there's 10 to the 22nd power stars in the universe. You know how many stars that is? A bunch. It's approximately the number of sands of grain on the seashore. That's a bunch of sand, isn't it? He says there's that many stars altogether. The silent embarrassment of modern astrophysics is that we do not know how even a single one of these stars managed to form. There's no lack of ideas, of course. We just can't substantiate them. That's out of a textbook. And I can quote a whole bunch of different people saying the same thing, and yet they believe in stellar evolution. What's the problem with star formation? Well, it goes against the gas laws. It's one of your reasons listed. It goes against the gas laws, and basically what we're going to say is this. The gas laws would have you know that there's a huge gas pressure that causes gases to expand. Open a bottle of perfume, you'll understand what I'm talking about, okay? But when it's hot, it's worse. So we have a very large pressure of expansion on the gases, a gas pressure. But what else we have is a very small gravity attraction on the particles. Now, supposedly, gravity pulls this stuff together, forming a star. Sounds good, right? But the gas pressure is too great. It can't happen. So what's the solution? Oh, there was a nearby supernova. And that supernova, a star exploding, produced enough shock wave to allow this stuff to, the pressure to go against the gas pressures. Sounds good? Except for one thing. You have to have a star exploding or dying before you can get another star. That doesn't work, does it? It doesn't explain where the first stars came about. Another problem, the law of biogenesis. Okay? Life only comes from life. We know that is true. Louis Pasteur and Reddy and others proved that a long time ago. And they teach you that in the textbook. But then flip over a couple more pages, the scientists now say, according to another textbook, that the first life came from non-living chemicals. Say, wait a minute, hold on, I thought we proved that we couldn't do that. Well, this is the current theory. Lightning zapping chemicals in the atmosphere produced amino acids which got together accidentally forming proteins in just the right order, and then the proteins plus about 5,000 other things got together and formed a cell by accident. Sounds like something in a storybook, all right? But really now, what's the probability of that occurring? Well, before we get into that, let's just mention this goes against the laws of thermodynamics. We are getting order from disorder, and yet thermodynamics says it goes the other way. All right? Everything is going downhill in the universe. Of course, the answer to that by evolution is pump enough energy into it, and you can get order from disorder. Sounds good, doesn't it? Well, in order to do that, you're going to have something that spells intelligence. You're going to have an energy converter so the energy doesn't destroy the particles that you're seeing right there, and they will at a rate of 1,000 times faster than what they're made. And number two, you need a plan, and a plan means a planner. Greater intelligence, doesn't it? So you're not going to go against thermodynamics, especially in the very formative stages of evolution of a cell. Well, the laws of probability are very important too. And I just wanted to let you know what the probability of forming that single protein was. That's not even life yet. That's not even a cell. The probability is one chance out of 10 to the 260th power. Now, for you, those that do not know big numbers, that's a big one, okay? If you were to count the number of marbles that can fit in the entire known universe, it'd only be 10 to the 84th power. So to get to 10 to the 260th, you multiply times 10, times 10, times 10, times 10, a lot of times, okay? That's what you have to do. 1 in 206, 10 to the 260th power. It's kind of like hiding a painted grain of sand somewhere in the world on one of the beaches and blindfolded. Go out and find it. That's the probability. And not only finding it once, you lucky guy, but finding it almost 12 times in a row hidden in different places. That's the probability of one single protein. And I said, it's just not going to happen at all. Well, a lot of evolutionists says, well, I know it's not very probable, but given enough time, anything can happen. And we have billions of years to play with. That's not enough time, folks. In fact, trillions of years is not enough time. You need many more than trillions. In fact, you can do a mathematical calculation and find out how many years it would take to be somewhat sure that it could happen. Do you have enough time? And that number is 10 to the 343rd power years. 10 to the 12th is a trillion. So you multiply that number times 10 times 10 times 10, 331 times, and that's how much time we need. The universe isn't that old, is it? I don't believe it's going to happen by chance. Well, you can go a little further. That's just one protein. What about a cell? Wick Ramashing and Sir Fred Hoyle decided to calculate it. Now, this was an agnostic and an atheist decided to try it. And they found the probability for forming a cell by chance is 1 out of 10, not to the 260th power, but 10 to the 40,000th power. They actually were quoted in a newspaper, says, there must be a God. I agree with them. They said it was more likely for a tornado. More likely for a tornado to sweep through a junkyard and produce a Boeing 747 complete and ready to fly than to produce the cell. They're still looking for a way around their conclusions. All right? The probability of a bacteria reported in Sky and Telescope magazine, June 1997, said the probability of that was 1 chance in 10 to the 100 billionth power. Is it going to happen? No way. The statistics just say no. It's not going to happen. Well, let's look at some logical considerations. First of all, I don't think there are selective advantages for some of the transitional forms. Can you imagine what a half wing, half leg is going to do? You can't fly, you can't walk very well, you're going to be good meat for the first animal that comes along. Okay? Now, according to evolution, a land animal such as a cow turn into the whales. Right? Can you imagine the intermediate forms? What it's going to look like? In Dr. Gish's book, Amazing Story of Creation, which we have on our book table there, he has a great picture of what it all looked like. And in fact, he even states in lectures a lot of times, you know, if evolution got the whole thing right, up to the point of when it needed to lose the udder, it would be called an utter failure. Well, imagine reptiles turning into mammals. Now, here's a big problem for that. Reptiles have 3 bones in their jaw. Mammals have 2. But mammals have an extra bone in their ear. So somehow, according to evolution, the extra bone in the jaw of a reptile migrated over millions of years to become a very precise ear bone in mammals. Think about the intermediates. There's a big problem here. For a while this jawbone is migrating, this guy certainly couldn't eat very well, and it certainly couldn't hear either. A big problem for evolution. Well, let me switch slides here. You know, you're getting about 3 slides per minute. All right. Birds. Reptiles are supposedly going to evolve into birds. Precision, flight, and everything. And there's a big problem right there. But let me mention just a couple of other problems that everybody has to face. Let's say reptiles have a type of lung where the air basically comes in and out. That's how the interchange goes, so that the blood picks up the oxygen. An in-and-out system. Well, that's not efficient enough for a bird that has to have sustained flight. It has to have a lot of oxygen. So what happens? It has a continuous flow system. Goes in one spot, goes out in another spot like a hose. Now, wait a minute. How do you go from a reptile lung, a dead-end system, to a continuous flow system without shutting down the whole process, remodeling it, starting over again? In the meantime, the transitions aren't going to be able to breathe, are they? This is a big problem for evolution, and no answers whatsoever for this one. According to evolution, scales turn into feathers. In fact, they say scales are frayed feathers. But when you actually look at the structure of a feather, and you notice that that doesn't really look like a frayed scale at all, does it? With all these hooks and barbules, kind of like Velcro. There's no way that that is a frayed scale. Another problem, have we ever found a half feather, half scale? No. They're one or the other, nothing in between. You might have heard about the dinosaur that they found with feathers. Well, you might as well forget that now. The reason you forget it is that a group of experts in the field observed. They went there, instead of just listening to newspaper articles, they observed, they found out it wasn't feathers at all. Okay? So forget that one. Life is also amazingly complex. It is very much suited for its environment, and not only that, it has an interdependence of parts. Let me explain what I mean by looking at some of these wonderful creatures. Let's look at the dolphin. First of all, dolphins have a sonar where they can detect the difference under sand when a quarter or a dime is hidden. They'll tell you if it's a dime or a quarter and go get the dime or the quarter for you. Amazing, huh? How can they do that? Such precision we'd never expect, should we? Well, do navigation systems like this come into being accidentally? No way. They sure don't. There are other things about the dolphins, really complex. First of all, the way they dive, they go down so deep, and because of their chest cavity, it should collapse on them. They're also a mammal. That means they give birth to live young. And we've got in the live young birth, and we have to have a certain temperature regulation in order to do that. One magazine, in fact, Discover, said this in March 1997. It says, by all rights, life in the sea should leave a dolphin baked, crushed, and sterile. This graceful animal avoids such a fate only by slipping through the loopholes of physiology. I think it was designed that way. Okay? Don't you? All right. As we go a little further here, we look at the woodpecker. It's an amazing machine for pecking holes in the tree. Okay? It's a living jackhammer. It has special tripod claws. It has a shock absorber between the beak and the skull. And I'll tell you what, many other very important features. But one thing I really want to point out is when it gets that hole dug, it's got a real problem. The insect it was going after probably escaped down the inside of the bark. But fortunately for him, it has this long, sticky tongue. Puts it in, slaps it in, gets his dinner. Great lunch, huh? Good bug. Well, actually, here's the problem. That tongue is 4.5 times the length of its head. So if it tries to put it in its mouth when it gets the bug, it's going to choke to death. You don't see woodpeckers running around with their tongue wrapped around their neck or stuck in the shirt pocket, do you? Of course not. So what does this woodpecker do? Actually, what it does is it has a special compartment, a storage compartment, that comes out of the back of the mouth, wraps around the skull, attaches up there in the beak region. When he needs it, out it comes. Okay? Special muscles to help retract it. Great system. Which come first, or came first? The long tongue or the storage compartment? Now, evolutionists say, well, both of them had to evolve at the same time. I'll tell you what, there's a lot of things that would have to control that. So we're looking at a lot of miracles in that regard if this is going to happen. I'd rather believe in one miracle God created. The neck of the giraffe. You know, here's a real problem. You've got a big heart that's 2.5 feet long, pumping blood clear up to the head of the giraffe when he's trying to eat the top of the trees. And now you have that huge force of the pump, and now this poor old giraffe bends down to take a drink. And you have that pump still pumping, and you have gravity now basically forcing the blood down into its head as well. By all rights, this should just blow the brains out of this poor giraffe. But that doesn't happen because it has special valves and muscles that constrict the flow and compartments to absorb some of that blood. I don't think that happened by accident as well. Vomiter beetles are another great creatures. They produce chemicals which act like a bomb, and they can shoot it into the face of an enemy with machine gun rapidity, and it's 212 degrees Fahrenheit. That's right. Pretty amazing, isn't it? Now, have you ever thought of a problem with evolving a bomb inside of your own abdomen? Slowly and gradually by mistakes? Well, you figured out what's going to happen already. You're going to blow up the poor beetle. Now, you can imagine how maybe a stink bug could have these processes, and natural selection can basically weed out the ones, eventually producing something that's inside, internal. All right? But imagination is not observation. All right? Well, another creature, the sea anemone. These sea anemones have all these tentacles. What's interesting is they have stinger cells at the end of each of these tentacles. They're like little missiles. Poison dart system. They come equipped with a spring and a missile, a trap door, and a trigger. The fish hits the trigger, and all of a sudden, when it hits that trigger, that releases the trap door, the dart fires, shooting the fish, and now the sea anemone has a dinner because it paralyzes it. Pretty interesting, huh? Missiles don't happen by accident, do they? Accidents happen to missiles, but not the other way around. But now, how would you like to eat one of those things? You'd really get a bellyache, wouldn't you? Well, there is a creature that does. It's called the nudibranch, sea slug. In fact, it has its own tentacles, but it doesn't have its own dart system. So it eats the entire sea anemone whole, poison darts and all. They don't fire. Chemical reaction, we believe. And the whole thing is digested except the poison dart capsules. And now what happens? You have all these darts rattling around in the stomach, and they get ferried by special cilia in tubes, hollow tubes like straws, all the way from the stomach up to the ends of those tentacles. Now, the poison dart is put right into the end of the tentacle. It's now armed and ready to fire. First fish that goes by hits the trigger. Bam, these things fire again. This is a creature that pirates another creature's missile system. How did that happen by accident? It's not going to. Process of metamorphosis. How do you get butterflies from caterpillars and vice versa? No explanation from evolution. It's amazing. And incidentally, did you know that monarchs and different type of butterflies migrate just like birds do? Migration, without going into detail, is tremendously complex. No good explanation whatsoever. Talking about flight, the dragonfly has ability to fly better than some of our aircraft do. And in fact, it has two different wing sets. And you say, oh, mutation. A copier gave them two sets. Except one is totally different than the other set. The first one sets up turbulence. The second set picks up on that turbulence, and it gets a tremendous lift, 15 times its body weight. Our best aircraft can't even muster twice its body weight in lift. We're studying these things to try to find out how to make better aircraft, and if we can't do it, do you think this happened by accident? I don't think so. Well, let's look at the gecko lizard. All right, he's looking at you, but what I want to focus in a lot of specialized features is just one, its foot structure. Those toes have over a million separate little, you might say, holding points, so it can walk right across the ceiling. If you put glass on upside down, it can walk upside down on a glass plate. Why? Well, it has so many of these things. There's a pump that when it's ready to walk across something like glass, it'll actually pump the blood into it, and it puts pressure on every one of these pads. Now you have on each toe about a million pads, microscopic, holding on to the minute projections even in glass. And then you have special release valves, and the creature kind of rolls his foot backwards, not in the normal way that a foot would go for walking, but it goes backwards to release them. Otherwise, it's stuck like you would be if you handled super glue without gloves, right? It would be stuck forever onto that plate of glass or the wall. Amazing system. They didn't know about this thing, could understand the system until the electron microscope showed how it worked. Well, the human brain is amazing. Now, can computers happen by accident? No, we all know computers have accidents. But computers don't happen by accidents, neither do computer programs. And this brain, your human brain, is better than any computer that has ever been developed. I say that's a real problem for evolution to explain it. The human eye. Do cameras and video cameras evolve by accident? No. And yet, this is much more refined than even our best camera systems. It does a lot better. And then when you look at the biochemical reactions occurring at the back of the eye and then transmitting that to electrical information that goes to the brain to set up more biochemical reactions, you say, hold on, something else is going on here. This didn't happen by accident. Well, the question is, can blind chance produce seeing eyes? I don't think so. But you know, according to evolution, that eye didn't happen once. It happened at least four or five times by accident in different lines. In fact, you see, the human eye is very similar to that of a squid's eye. Now, do we have a great-great-granddaddy that leads both to squids and humans? No, there isn't any, and evolution doesn't say it. They say, well, this is an example of convergent evolution. It's one thing to call it convergent evolution, but how did it happen? Well, they say similar environmental pressures produce similar features. But our environment isn't the same as a squid, is it? Well, that doesn't work either. Tremendous problems with convergent evolution, and yet it is everywhere. It is everywhere, and evolution really has a hard time explaining it. Now, you might imagine how a primitive, simple, light-receiving cell might change into a seeing eye over millions and millions of years, but that's not observation, is it? And we don't see that actually occurring today. First of all, we notice that the simple cell, as a lot of people would think, is not simple. It is a chemical factory, complete with a computer system, recognition on the cell walls. We have transport systems, etc. It's like UPS going on in the cell, right? It's just absolutely amazing. The simple cell isn't simple at all. Those who really pushed Darwinism in the first 50 years thought the simple cell was simple until we looked at it under great microscopic investigation. We found out by observation it's no longer simple. They thought it was just nothing but like a mass of jelly, the cell. They didn't know that it was a computer system. When you dive deeper in the cell, it's even worse than that. In fact, Michael Denton, who was an agnostic when he wrote this book, Evolution, A Theory and Crisis, started musing and thinking, is it even conceivable, I'm going to paraphrase him, that something as complicated as a cell could come about by random chances? Okay? And then he said, and the cell is above our own creative genius. He never answered the question in his book. All right? But I heard later he became a Christian. I hope that's true. How about what's going on inside the cell? Well, what's happening right now with many of you is you're digesting your lunch. Well, the sugar is going to be broken down to produce energy to help you keep your eyes open, okay? That's what's happening. Now, what's interesting about this particular reaction is that in order to do it, you have to, and you're going to produce energy, you have to invest two packets of energy here in yellow before you get any returns whatsoever. And if you leave your investment in the reaction long enough, you go down to pyruvate, eventually you get down to carbon dioxide and water, you will now gain a total of 38 packets of energy. So you invested two, got 30 back, 38 back. That's a great investment, right? Put that one in your portfolio. Now, how does your body know it's okay to invest two things in a natural process in order to get such an investment? That shows foreknowledge planning. Okay? Otherwise you wouldn't do that by natural things. Notice that every one of these steps right here, the red dots, there has to be specific enzymes that catalyze this reaction. And what's interesting about these enzymes is every one of them has to be perfectly fit to what it's working on. Whether it be a protein or any kind of substrate, it has to have a perfect fit like a glove over a hand, otherwise it doesn't work. So they both had to come into being at the same time. That's a real problem for evolution. Well, you look a little further. Inside the cells, you have this thing called DNA. They found you have now DNA and RNA and a whole bunch of other things. But, you know, the structure is so complicated, and it gives you a computer program within your body that spells out in one cell what you're going to look like, color of hair, color of eyes, etc. It's just amazing. And then when they found out the relationship between all these things, they found out not only was it a computer program, but it was a copy machine as well. Now, copy machines don't come into accident, do they? Okay? Or come about by accident. Cohen, writing in a magazine article called Darwin is Wrong, A Study in Probability, says, at that moment, when the RNA-DNA system became understood, the debate between evolutionists and creationists should have come to a screeching halt. Whoa. Okay? Evolution is not going to explain it. This type of complicated structure will not work. Get this thing to work a little better. There we go. Another big problem. It takes about 70 proteins to make DNA. And yet it takes DNA to make protein. Hold on. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? And that's a big problem for evolution, isn't it? Which came first? Well, evolutionists sometimes say, I know all these design systems. They're really unique, but you cannot tell the difference between something that has been designed and something that just happened strictly by accident. Oh, really? They say design can come from just accidents over millions of years. Not the type of design I'm showing you that has everything working together, otherwise none of it works. Okay? You know, I beg to differ with them. We can tell whether or not design can happen. You see those arrowheads? Now, you can't see the Indian that made them, right? But they happened, didn't they? Now, did erosion produce those things? I say, no, they were designed. All right? Let's look one further. Let's look at this painting here. Did this happen by, you might say, an explosion in a paint shop? You wouldn't believe so, would you? Bargaining for more time. You wouldn't expect so, I'm sure. Okay, same thing with what we see in the living world. Let me just mention one called blood clotting. Blood clotting is tremendously complicated. In order to keep you from bleeding to death, you have to have this thing called fibrinogen. Okay? And in fact, it exists in a non-active form. If it was an active form, guess what? You would coagulate right now. All right? You wouldn't be able to move after this lecture. I hope you can now. But anyhow, you also have to have a whole bunch of other things in here to regulate this blood clotting, because guess what? You've got to stop the blood clot in the right time too, otherwise you coagulate, right? And unless it's activated, nothing happens. So you have to have all these things going on to form a net of fibrinogen that's cut here, forming to the capillaries, in order to stop the red blood cells. That's basically what happens. All these things are needed. All need to be activated, so we have more than what's shown in the picture. And all works, or none of it works. Now, wait a minute. All or nothing process, you're not going to evolve one step and then another step by slow and gradual processes, are you? You're either going to bleed to death or you coagulate. Well, Behe wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box, and he calls this sort of thing an irreducible complexity at the molecular level. Okay? That means you can't go any lower than that. Well, let me give you another example of that. Molecular motors. Molecular motors come equipped with UV joints, bushings and rotors and all this good stuff that you would think was in your automobile. Now, motors and automobiles don't come about by accident, and neither do these molecular motors, and Behe shows that there's anything simpler you can get. Nothing whatsoever. Well, immunity. It's amazing. Amazing problem for evolution. Your body has to sense when something is good or bad. Has to recognize something. And then what happens is your antibody basically says, I know, I see that shape, and if it's a perfect fit, it can take care of it. If it's not a perfect shape, it kind of gives a feedback message to the factory that says, we need something close, and they'll go into a whole series of things making something that fits better so they can get rid of this antibody. All right? It's kind of like a locksmith working. It's just amazing. And in order for this immunity to work, guess what? You're going to have enough of these kind of creatures, not creatures, but things in your body, diverse, to recognize many different things. You have to recognize good or bad. You have to be able to destroy it. And you have to have tolerance. That means you don't destroy your own cells. That's basically what happens with AIDS. It's an irreducible system. All or nothing, evolution really has a hard time doing it. Behe wrote, the scientific literature has no answers to the question of the origin of the immune system. No answers whatsoever. Another problem, feedback mechanism and homeostasis. You all know what I mean by this. You know, you take your temperature. There are certain things in your body which regulate your temperature in narrow limits. You have the same thing with a pH balance. You have the same thing with sugar balance, acid as well. If it's not working that way, you're dead. Okay? It doesn't work. It's not good. Well, there are many other systems I can show you, but I've just given you 50 scientific reasons, I think, notice that emphasis, that evolution is wrong. Okay? Some may argue with me. And for those who really want to argue, guess what? Let me give you a few other ones. I didn't even talk about the lack of leftovers in our body. They thought they had all kinds of leftovers, and now they only have a couple, and those mean nothing except for the appendix, which has just lately been shown to have a function. I haven't talked about information theory, a big problem for evolution. I haven't said that the normal proofs of evolution don't even work. They don't cut it. How do you get symbiosis, where you get a fish that'll clean the teeth of another fish without getting eaten? All right? Evolution's going to have a hard time explaining that thing. And then finally, beauty. What's the purpose of beauty? Well, they say it's a better mating advantage. Well, maybe so. Albino peacocks, though, have been found to mate at the same frequency as beautiful peacocks. Well, we look at flowers. Well, maybe the insects pollinate because they're beauty. Well, maybe so. But does that explain beauty on the microscopic level? Beauty is in the high eye of the beholder, and I think it's put there for us to be able to recognize God. God and His entire creation. You can look at all the systems of your body, all the biochemical pathways, and there are numerous ones, and then you'd be up to at least 100 reasons evolution couldn't work. Well, we notice that there are requirements for a scientific theory. One of the requirements is we have to observe what's going on. You can't observe evolution, can't you? But you can't observe creation either. Well, then it's not even a valid scientific theory. It's not even that. That's true. But what's the evidence for evolution? Okay? I like what Dawkins said. Richard Dawkins, we quoted him. He was in March 1997, quoted by World Magazine. He said, "We don't need evidence. We know it to be true." It sounds like a religious argument, doesn't it? Evolution is religion. Right? It's religion. And some of the proponents of that religion degrade humans. Neil Bell writes, "The fact is we humans are just as much animals as any worm, toad, or pig." That was in a textbook, folks. And students coming up through that kind of instruction, what are they going to be told? Evolution, what do they feel? How's that do? What does that do for your self-esteem? Right? Problem number one, doesn't it? And number two, they're going to act like it. All right? That's not good either. And then they're going to judge what they feel about issues based upon who they came from. If they came from monkey, they think we're nothing but a glorified animal. What's wrong with homosexuality? What's wrong with euthanasia? What's wrong with making my own rules? All right? What's wrong with abortion? If we're nothing but glorified animals, what's wrong with cloning? Okay? Those are the people that are coming up through our system right now because evolution almost exclusively is being taught. I'd rather go with a belief that in the beginning, God created heavens and the earth. That's what I'd rather go with. Well, we have books over here, just underneath the scoreboard over there, right on that side. Lots of books on creation. Make sure you come and get some of those. On the tear-off that you have, it's a little off-centered. That's in favor. That's because of evolution. Okay? Tear it off and fill it out and give it to us in that booth. We'll put you on our mailing list for Think and Believe, keep you abreast of the latest scientific discoveries. We also have camps, and we'll send you some camp brochures, too. And I just came from 2 weeks of family camps. We have 1 week, then back-to-back another week. And there's fishing, rappelling, horseback riding. It's a real vacation. And you can do it probably in conjunction with next year's conference. Come to our camp, come to the conference. It'll work beautifully for you. Well, for more information, write to us, and there's the address. Okay? Thank you very much. Appreciate your great attention. All or nothing process, you're not going to evolve one step and then another step by slow and gradual processes, are you? You're either going to bleed to death or you coagulate. Well, Behe wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box, and he calls this sort of thing irreducible complexity at the molecular level. Okay? That means you can't go any lower than that. Well, let me give you another example of that. molecular motors. Molecular motors come equipped with UV joints, bushings and rotors and all this good stuff that you would think was in your automobile. Now, motors in automobiles don't come about by accident, and neither do these molecular motors. And B, he shows that there's no simpler you can, anything simpler you can get. Nothing whatsoever. Well, immunity. It's amazing. Amazing problem for evolution. Your body has to sense when something is good or bad. Has to recognize something. And then what happens is your antibody basically says, I know, I see that shape, and if it's a perfect fit, it can take care of it. If it's not a perfect shape, it kind of gives a feedback message to the factory that says, we need something close, and they'll go into a whole series of things making something that fits better so they can get rid of this antibody. All right? It's kind of like a locksmith working. It's just amazing. And in order for this immunity to work, guess what? You're going to have enough of these kind of creatures, not creatures, but things in your body to burst, to recognize many different things. You have to recognize good or bad. You have to be able to destroy it. And you have to have tolerance. That means you don't destroy your own cells. And that's basically what happens with AIDS. It's an irreducible system. All or nothing. Evolution really has a hard time doing it. Behe wrote, the scientific literature has no answers to the question of the origin of the immune system. No answers whatsoever. Another problem, feedback mechanism and homeostasis. You all know what I mean by this. You know, you take your temperature. There are certain things in your body which regulate your temperature in narrow limits. You have the same thing with the pH balance. You have the same thing with sugar balance, acid as well. If it's not working that way, you're dead. Okay? It doesn't work. It's not good. Well, there are many other systems I can show you, but I've just given you 50 scientific reasons I think, notice that emphasis, that evolution is wrong. Okay? Some may argue with me. And for those who really want to argue, guess what? Let me give you a few other ones. I didn't even talk about the lack of leftovers in our body. They thought they had all kinds of leftovers, and now they only have a couple, and those mean nothing except for the appendix, which has just lately been shown to have a function. I haven't talked about information theory, a big problem for evolution. I haven't said that the normal proofs of evolution don't even work. They don't cut it. How do you get symbiosis, where you get a fish that'll clean the teeth of another fish without getting eaten? All right? Evolution's going to have a hard time explaining that thing. And then finally, beauty. What's the purpose of beauty? Well, they say it's a better mating advantage. Well, maybe so. Albino peacocks, though, have been found to mate at the same frequency as beautiful peacocks. Well, we look at flowers. Well, maybe the insects pollinate because of their beauty. Well, maybe so. But does that explain beauty on the microscopic level? Beauty is in the high eye of the beholder, and I think it's put there for us to be able to recognize God. God and His entire creation. You can look at all the systems of your body, all the biochemical pathways, and there are numerous ones, and then you'd be up to at least 100 reasons evolution couldn't work. Well, we noticed that there are requirements for a scientific theory. One of the requirements is we have to observe what's going on. You can't observe evolution, can't you? But you can't observe creation either. Well, then it's not even a valid scientific theory. It's not even that. That's true. But what's the evidence for evolution? Okay? I like what Dawkins said. Richard Dawkins, we quoted him. He was in March 1997, quoted by World Magazine. He said, we don't need evidence. We know it to be true. It sounds like a religious argument, doesn't it? Evolution is religion. All right? It's religion. And some of the proponents of that religion degrade humans. Neil Bell writes, the fact is we humans are just as much animals as any worm, toad, or pig. That was in a textbook, folks. And students coming up through that kind of instruction, what are they going to be told? Evolution, what do they feel? How's that do? What does that do for your self-esteem? Right? Problem number one, doesn't it? And number two, they're going to act like it. All right? That's not good either. And then they're going to judge what they feel about issues based upon who they came from. If they came from monkey, they think we're nothing but a glorified animal. What's wrong with homosexuality? What's wrong with euthanasia? What's wrong with making my own rules? All right? What's wrong with abortion? If we're nothing but glorified animals, what's wrong with cloning? Okay? Those are the people that are coming up through our system right now because evolution almost exclusively is being taught. I'd rather go with a belief that in the beginning, God created heavens and the earth. That's what I'd rather go with. Well, we have books over here, just underneath the scoreboard over there, right on that side. Lots of books on creation. Make sure you come and get some of those. On the tear-off that you have, it's a little off-centered. That's in favor. That's because of evolution. Okay? Tear it off and fill it out and give it to us in that booth. We'll put you on our mailing list for Think and Believe. Keep you abreast of the latest scientific discoveries. We also have camps, and we'll send you some camp brochures, too. And I just came from 2 weeks of family camps. We have 1 week, then back-to-back another week. And there's fishing, rappelling, horseback riding. It's a real vacation. And you can do it probably in conjunction with next year's conference. Come to our camp, come to the conference. It'll work beautifully for you. Well, for more information, write to us, and there's the address. Okay? Thank you very much. Appreciate your great attention.